Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion and Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Our speaker is Benjamin Lazier from the Department of History at Reed College. Professor Lazier's lecture is titled Miracles in an Age of Technological Reproducibility. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor of Religion and Acting Director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies, Michael Zank.
Our speaker, Ben Lazier, is the author of an award-winning and outstandingly lucid book on Weimar period political theology called God Interrupted, Heresy and the European Imagination Between the World Wars, that classifies many well-known intellectuals of the Weimar period into two basic types, namely pantheists and Gnostics. This basic distinction between a monistic and a dualistic vision of reality continues to be relevant today. Lazier currently works on conceptions of globalism or the rhetoric of one earth in modern times. Tonight, he will use Walter Benjamin's notion of technical reproducibility to think through a major topos in the renewal of theology associated with the crisis of modernity thinkers of the period following the Great War, namely miracles and their validity in a post-Enlightenment world. In her Walgreen Foundation lectures on the human condition that were published in 1958, the German-born Jewish political philosopher and Heidegger student Hannah Arendt wrote, quote, "The earth is the very quintessence of the human condition. An earthly nature, for all we know, may be unique in the universe in providing human beings with a habitat in which they can move and breathe without effort and without artifice." End quote. Arendt's reference to the earth as the quintessence of the human condition is a far cry from some of the most common ways in which we refer to earth today. We are either unaware of the earth because we take our existence and what nourishes us for granted, or we feel daunted by the looming environmental apocalypse. To be sure, we may also think of earth as the dust from which we are taken and to which we will in the end return. Earth is clearly more and different from globe, a planet to be sure, but for us it is the world. Jews and Christians traditionally see our being in the world as part of creation. But talk of creation is today mired in debates on evolution versus intelligent design. What was at stake at the famous Scopes trial of 1925 and what remains at stake now is the question of the truth about human existence. Here is what Franz Rosenzweig wrote about creation. Rosenzweig was a modern Jewish thinker about whose conversion from a world denying Gnosticism to a more orthodox Jewish or Christian affirmation of the goodness of the world we heard from Ben Pollack in the last lecture in this series. And here's what Rosenzweig wrote 7 years before the Scopes trial took place, toward the end of the Great War, concerning creation and the possibility of experiencing miracles. "The becoming manifest of the everlasting mystery or secret of creation is that ever-renewed miracle of revelation. In order to experience reality as one creation, the elements of our experience, the primordial God, historical man, and an ever-evolving natural world must be revealed to us as mutually constitutive wholes, as an everlasting birth out of the depth." To be sure, Rosenzweig knows this is difficult to imagine. It requires for us to experience creation as the miracle that it is. And no other philosopher was more eloquent in describing for us the nearly insurmountable difficulties the modern person has in experiencing miracles. Professor Lazier.
Well, thank you, Michael, for the exceptionally kind invitation to come out here tonight. Some of you might be familiar with a book called God Is Not Great, which is one of the more vituperative broadsides against the Bible and its instrumentalization that's been penned in recent years. This book came with a subtitle called How Religion Poisons Everything, which, when you think about it for a minute, actually doubles as a kind of theory of secularization. The author of this book, God Is Not Great, Christopher Hitchens, was asked in the course of his book tour to name a favorite scene from the Bible, and here is what he had to say. "Casting the first stone is a lovely story, even though we found out how much it wasn't in the Bible to begin with, and the first of the miracles. Jesus changes water into wine. You can't object to that." Now, I admit that I love this story about Hitchens' favorite story. For Hitchens, of course, this story is make-believe, and its appeal to him is merely another way of saying that a world with more wine sounds like a pleasant place to be, as does a world with more vodka, more gin, and more scotch, which, as he notes in another interview, happens to be his drink of choice. But it turns out that you don't have to be a teetotaler to object to this story. The miracle that it recounts is a model for precisely the kind of miracle, namely a technical achievement, a work, and an apparent violation of nature that some of the leading theologians of the Weimar era wanted to contest. And they would contest this model for some of the same reasons that would later lead men like Hitchens to declare the story rubbish in the first place. And so today what I want to do is talk about the discourse of the miracle in the Weimar era and beyond. Franz Rosenzweig, who Michael mentioned in his introduction, once called the miracle an embarrassment to much of post-Enlightenment theology. He expected the miracle to go extinct. But it turns out that in the Weimar era, it makes a remarkable comeback. And it becomes a kind of conduit for a series of controversies, not just theological controversies, but controversies, and not just controversies across confessions, but even across the disciplines. And so you could say that its survival was, in this sense, overdetermined. And just to give you a few examples, I get the sense that I'm speaking to a pretty mixed audience, so some of these examples might make sense to you, some of them won't, and we'll just hope for the best. But just to give you a few examples, there's a scholar of jurisprudence named Carl Schmitt, who famously invoked the miracle as an analog to the decision of the sovereign in a state of legal exception. And he wanted to recover the miracle to help him abet his attack on a liberal system of law, which had replaced sovereign decisions, he felt, with a system of technocratic administration. There's also a philosopher named Leo Strauss who devoted sustained attention to the miracle as he reconsidered the plausibility of the Enlightenment critique of religion. We have leading Protestant theologians such as Rudolf Bultmann, who I'll talk more about in a minute, and Karl Barth, who invoked the miracle as part of their wide-ranging critique of liberal theology. And we also have maverick natural scientists who invoke the miracle as a kind of metaphor in order to describe the exceptional, uncontrollable, and inexplicable dimensions of nature that seem to call into question claims to technological mastery. There are still others who came of age in the interwar era who would go still further. The philosopher Hannah Arendt, for example, later made use of the miracle as a controlling metaphor for the human condition itself. Now, Arendt's approach was idiosyncratic, and I'll talk a lot more about her a little bit later. There are a few things that we can say about sort of this broad group, that Arendt and most of the others interested in the miracle had a distinct, I guess we could call it a theological, political physiognomy. So first of all, they belonged to a post-liberal or an anti-liberal revision of the reigning forms of European thought, whether in theology, philosophy, or jurisprudence. Second, they shared an ambivalence about the technical achievements of modern science. They were also ambivalent about the works it produced, and even more fundamentally, about the model of nature that modern science presupposed. Arguments about the miracle, which apparently entail a suspension of the physical laws at work in a scientifically ordered natural world, could therefore double as debates over law writ large, whether natural law, political, economic, or divine. These people also raised a pressing question. Is a life lived in thrall to a kind of routinized lawfulness, is a life lived in thrall to routine, any kind of life at all? And last, this group typically shared hostility to Enlightenment rationalism and to the anthropological prejudices of modern thought. And for them all, Wunderscheu, which is a German word which I guess we could describe as an aversion to the miracle, for them all, Wunderscheu was a foundational characteristic, and for some of them, a foundational error of the modern era. Now, today I want to focus on two examples, a theologian named Rudolf Bultmann, basically, I want to talk about his discussion of the miracle and the way in which the terms of his discussion were later taken up by Hannah Arendt in her wide-ranging critique of technocracy, which she developed in a really amazing book called The Human Condition, which was published in 1958. But first, let me just tell you about why I chose these two. I have several aims in mind. So given some of the examples that I've just enumerated, people like Schmidt, Strauss, and Arendt, it's clear that in both the interwar and postwar eras, the miracle would jump theological ship, which raises the question of whether it then landed on secular shores. So one aim of my talk is basically just to ask whether thinking about the miracle can help us think about secularization in the interwar era and beyond. Now, secularization literally refers to ways of becoming worldly. It's a meaning that we sometimes miss in English, but that's hard to miss or hard to overlook in its German equivalent, a word called Verweltlichung, which we could literally but clumsily render as worldification. So usually we use the word secularization to refer to an evacuation of the divine or the transfer of ecclesiastical to civil authority or to a process by which the city of God cedes power to the city of man. But the direction is easily reversed, and this is really crucial. The direction is easily reversed so that what at first appears as an evacuation reveals itself as an occupation or an infiltration instead. And it's not difficult to see something of this in the miracle. The miracle also refers to a becoming worldly. It refers to a becoming worldly of God. Perhaps this is counterintuitive, but on this view, we can think of the miracle as itself a secularization of the divine. It's a way for God to manifest himself in this world, let's say as a sign, as a portent, as a spectacle, as the providential intervention from a transcendent beyond in the this-worldly lives of men. And so the revival of the miracle in the interwar era embodied something of the double movement embedded in the concept of secularization itself. The miracle could signal God's return to the world, but it could also signal God's definitive eviction from it, and at the very same time. The broader point, though, for the moment, is just this. In matters secular, the miracle can be good to think with. Now, the miracle can be good to think with regarding a related problem, and this is our stories about the so-called disenchantment of the world. When we talk about disenchantment, we usually associate it with the flight of the gods. Magic, mystery, and miracles, for all of their substantial differences, have been progressively banished from the scene of the world, or so this story goes. In their place have arisen other institutions and authorities, bureaucracy, natural science, capitalism, liberal democracy, technology. Together, in Max Weber's famous words, they have all erected, I'm quoting here, the tremendous cosmos of the modern economic order, and they have made modernity the era of the iron cage. But these new authorities that Weber is talking about, or we might call them the new idols have proved to be harsh masters and have understandably provoked iconoclasm. Sometimes this iconoclasm has come in the form of a violent rage against the machine, a politics that has as its aim the springing of modernity's discontents from their prison. Sometimes it comes in more syrupy forms of defiance, escape, or even therapy. Things like yoga come to mind for me, at least most immediately. But also things like a vogue for spirituality divorced from ecclesiastical institutions, things like paganism, East Asian religions, Eastern European mysticism, the occult, and an unfocused but powerful yearning for a new heterocosmic era. This was meant to sound like a partly jocular account of the contemporary spiritual scene. It seems like partially failed. It is, in fact, or also a reasonably serious description of Weber's Europe in the years after Versailles. This era saw a profusion of religiosity, often directed against the agents and institutions of modern disenchantment. Weber saw this around him. He also understood its attractions, but he also disapproved. In his lecture, a very famous lecture of 1918 called Science as a Vocation, He referred to this trend as a flight from reality, a self-submission, a determined sacrifice of the intellect. He also expected re-enchantment to fail, or even worse, to create still more intractable modern monsters. But what if miracles? How does their return fit in this story? Well, on the one hand, the desire to revive miracles in an age for which they were unsuited and maybe even unintelligible might understandably be associated with efforts to re-enchant the world, and in part, this was in fact the case. On the other hand, it turns out that the recovery of miracles was diverse, and in the hands of some of the leading theologians of the era, Protestants especially, they had the ironic effect of abetting the very disenchantment that many of their contemporaries were so eager to reverse. So it turns out that miracles can disenchant the world, not just enchant it. We're now onto section two, and this section is called Against Nature, Miracles and the Theology of Crisis. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the term theology of crisis, it refers to an important movement in Protestant thinking, especially in the interwar era. They actually take their name from a journal that a number of them founded called Zwischen den Zeiten, Between the Times. And basically, to live between the times was to live in an era of crisis. Michael actually made reference to a few of these thinkers in his introduction. These are people who might be associated with a kind of Gnostic or a neo-Gnostic theology. Okay, so this section is called Against Nature, Miracles and the Theology of Crisis. Now, it might sound surprising, but Bultmann and, that is, Rudolf Bultmann, the theologian, and Christopher Hitchens, Christian and atheist, famous theologian and famous inebriate, it might sound surprising, but they in fact share a great deal. Both of them are heir to the Enlightenment critique of religion and of miracles in particular. They pick up where Baruch Spinoza and David Hume especially left off. So Hume famously defined miracles in a book called The Enquiry Concerning Human Understanding. This is in 1748. He defined miracles as a transgression of a law of nature by a particular volition of the deity or by the interposition of some invisible agent. Hume continued by arguing for the impossibility of miracles. Laws of nature, as laws, by definition, cannot be transgressed, he said. Events that are attributed to supernatural causes lie beyond the scope of such laws altogether. And so the idea of the miracle as a violation of the laws of nature, it turns out to be logically self-defeating. Now, this definition, you could say this definition of the miracle has become naturalized, as it were, but it's worth noting that it is first and foremost a modern invention. It is foreign, for example, to the thought of late antiquity, not only among pagans such as Aristotle, who tended to define the miracle in terms of statistical irregularity, not in terms of anti-naturalness, and also among church fathers such as Augustine, who tended to associate the miracle with creation, not with the revocation of its lawfulness. So the notion of miracle that is described by Hume truly comes into its own only with the rise of a modern natural science that figures nature as lawful, processual, and mechanical. It's almost as if late modernity had to create this notion of the miracle as its necessary counterconcept, even if only then to argue for its incoherence. Now, things become more complicated once we submit Hume's definition to a few basic questions. First, what is meant by an act in these circumstances, and of what kind do we speak? An act as opposed to what? What is the lawfulness of which Hume writes, the nature of which he writes, and not to mention their combination? What precisely is a transgression? Is a transgression a momentary suspension of an otherwise lawful order? Is it a permanent breach in a continuum? Is it a revelation of a second, otherly ordered world, say a world of faith or a world of morals, that's parallel to the lawfulness of the natural one? And last, who is it that performs the miracle? A transcendent God? A God made manifest on earth? A prophet? A miracle worker? Or this worldly magician? So all these questions we can pose to Hume, and it turns out that all of these questions circulated among those who engaged in Weimar-era miracle talk. Now, to address them, we can begin where Hitchens did, namely with the wine. The act in question is a transformation, and its effect, the wine, is a work of art, or more broadly construed, it is a work of artifice. It's something that we make. And so when I use the word art in this presentation, a lot of times I'll be kind of using it as artifice, things that we make. In other words, the miracle when water is turned into wine, is figured on the model of a technical achievement, and it produces a finished thing, an artwork. Now, of course, the means by which the work is executed is occult. If it is manufacture, which is literally a work of the hands, it is also prestidigitation, which means to wiggle your hands around, your fingers around really fast, but basically just means it's an act of magic. So the means by which the work is executed is occult, it's magical, mysterious. Nonetheless, it's still modeled on a kind of technical achievement. As a concept, this notion of miracle makes recourse to specific ideas about the natural world. Only against the background of a nature that is understood as lawful, ordered, and processual, or endowed with some form of regularity, does this transformation acquire a miraculous character. Now, it's precisely this line of thought that saturates Rudolf Bultmann's approach to the miracle, as he elaborated it in a very interesting essay called Zur Frage der Wunder, which just basically means on the question of the miracle. Now, Bultmann's stated aim in this essay was to save the idea of the miracle from two of its common distortions, which hinged on misreadings, or as he put it, willful misunderstandings, of the miracle's two basic components. First, that it is an act of God, and second, that it is a marvelous event contra naturam, a marvelous event against nature. One misreading, which was based on a false concept of God's omnipotence, has it that all historical events are in effect acts of God. This misreading embeds God's will in the working out of human history. A second misreading, which was based on a false concept of creation, has it that all natural occurrences, from the most everyday to the most unusual and inexplicable, are acts of God. So we have two misreadings, one that says that everything in history is God's doing, the other that says everything in nature is God's doing. Both of them, as you might be able to see, court a kind of pantheism, which literally just means God being everywhere. They court a kind of pantheism, one of history, the other of nature. And it's here that we can see the real source of Rudolf Bultmann's animus. And here's how he put it in a statement on liberal theology and what he called the latest movement in Protestant thought, namely the crisis theology with which he was sometimes affiliated. It is no more possible to see divine forces or the revelation of the divine in the interrelated complex of history and in historical forces than it is in the interrelatedness of nature and natural forces. Truly, here too, it is only man that is deified. Now, all of this was part and parcel of a revolt against liberal Protestant theology, which had stressed the presence of the godly in the worldly, and even the unfolding of religious truth in the course of human history. Barth and his followers reacted to such claims with disdain. How, after all, is one to discover God in a world that is soaked with the blood let by mass slaughter? So you need to recall that they're writing during and in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. They're wondering how it is that we can find God in the trenches among the poison gas. That some liberal theologians of the time, people like Adolf von Harnack, a Jewish philosopher named Hermann Cohen, that some liberal theologians for a time supported the war only confirmed the myopia and bankruptcy that their opponents were inclined to discover in them. So what post-liberal Protestants, people like Bultmann, Barth, and Gogarten, they wanted to reverse the liberal move that had stressed the presence of God in the world. The world, they held, was too debased to accommodate God, and so they removed him, they removed God from the scene of his creation. In effect, these theologians had exiled God, and his absence recalled to contemporaries the Gnostic idea of a hidden God, or a Deus absconditus. Now, it's pretty easy to see how this mood in Protestant thought abets the disenchantment of the world, right? Because they're basically saying God isn't to be found on the scene of the world anymore. But this also raises problems for the miracle. What, after all, can a miracle be in a disenchanted world that allows neither for works of God nor marvelous events that transgress the laws of nature? And here, Bultmann has some very interesting claims to make. First, he suggests that the only defensible notion of miracle must begin by accepting the claims of modern natural science in the terms of Hume's critique. So Bultmann, this Protestant theologian, is saying, yep, Hume is right. Nature is lawful, and it makes no sense to speak of its violation. On the other hand, if a notion of the miracle is to endure, and Bultmann wanted it to, it needs to be reimagined. And Bultmann reimagined it in a way that made the miracle still more powerfully anti-natural. This is why I'm calling this section Against Nature. Bultmann described the miracle not as a temporary abrogation of the laws of nature, but, as he put it, a radical canceling out of the, quote, manipulable workaday world that human beings do, in fact, inhabit. So whatever form the miracle might take, and this still remains to be specified, its effect is to rescue man from a world that is experienced as a world of human works. It rescues us from a world that we inhabit, that we experience as a world that we have made. Now, Bultmann's language is not incidental. Embedded in his phrase, we can find a wide-ranging critique of modern life, that the world is disclosed to man as something technologically and instrumentally manufactured, ordered, and shaped, or, in his words, manipulated and worked upon. Now, this sentiment was very common among Bultmann's contemporaries, not just theologians, but philosophers as well. But Bultmann's twist was to express this idea in the lexicon of theology. And here's how he put it. The sin of the whole world, he held, was to understand itself and God in terms of accomplishment and work. So the sin of the whole world is to understand itself or to understand yourself and God in terms of your own accomplishment and in terms of your own work. The miracle presents itself as a kind of antidote to this self-understanding. The miracle, he hoped, would cancel out this form of world disclosure because, and here I'm quoting again, it cancels out man's understanding of himself as capable of obtaining security by his work. So we're still left with a question, how is it that Bultmann's revised notion of the miracle is meant to redress this state of affairs? Well, we might say that the miracle that Bultmann describes doesn't undo this world or this sin, so much as it reveals a different mode of world disclosure altogether, an otherly ordered faith world. He talks a lot about the difference between faith ideas and work ideas, and he wants to say that most of the time we kind of live in the world as if the work ideas are kind of working, but what we need are more faith ideas. And so he concluded, first, that there is only one miracle, and that is the miracle of revelation. And he continued, this means revelation of God's grace for the godless, forgiveness. Now, when you think about it, this is really an astonishing thing to say. The miracle that Bultmann is describing seems to have little, indeed almost nothing to do with what usually comes to mind when I think of miracles, and in any event, this is not water into wine. This is not a bleeding statue. It's not an apparition of the Virgin Mary on a subway, on a sandwich, or even on a subway sandwich. It's not a miraculous healing. With due respect to post-war Germans, it is not a Wirtschaftswunder, which is an economic miracle. With due respect to salad dressing on the one hand and holy disciplinarians on the other, it is no miracle whip. And with still more respect due to Santa Claus, it is no miracle on 34th Street, although when we get to the end, we'll see that it's actually closest to that. So far as I know, which to be honest is not all that far, it represents a new notion of the miracle altogether. Bultmann's miracle does not refer to God's creation of nature, say the moment of Genesis, nor is it an instance of God's action into nature. Instead, it is an act of God that extracts the individual from a world originally disclosed to him as comprised of nature and human labor, human accomplishment, human works. And this is what makes it a lot more akin to gnosis. Okay, so just to sum up. First, the miracle is not a work, not a thing, not a creation, not a technological achievement. Instead, it is an act that cannot be reified, which is just a fancy term for thingified, to turn it into a thing. So it's an act that can't be turned into a thing. Second, the miracle is figured as a gift, or the gift of forgiveness, but without the corresponding concept of a debt, since God, Bultmann says, does not perform miracles and trade for return on a promise. So in this respect, we can see that the counter concepts of the miracle are sale and exchange. Next, the miracle takes the form of a revelation, not a creation. Indeed, it is in some ways a radical canceling out of creation insofar as it is a revelation that rescues us from the world of nature, the world of flesh, of creatureliness, of being a creature, and of human works, all of which, in their way, are synonyms for sin, at least in Bultmann's language. Last, it does all of this by disclosing an otherly ordered faith world that suspends the entirety of this one. The miracle is therefore not a violation of this or that law of nature, but the revelation of an alternative to processual, procedural, lawful nature as such. So altogether, in his effort to evade the implications of Hume's critique, namely that the notion of miracle as a violation of nature is logically self-defeating, Bultmann invented a notion of miracle that is still more radical and still more radically anti-natural. So let's take a step back now and just consider really quickly how Bultmann's approach implicates the questions that we began with, namely the stories we tell about secularization, about the disenchantment of the world, and about the historical, theological physiognomy of Weimar-era thinkers. So first, it's pretty easy to see how Bultmann's notion of the miracle is bound up with the problem of secularization. By stressing God's evacuation from creation, it makes the workaday world more worldly, if you like. And by focusing on the revelation of a heterocosmic faith world, heterocosmic just literally means otherly ordered, by focusing on the revelation of a heterocosmic faith world, it implicitly leaves questions about that worldly world to a godless natural science. The consequence seems to be a notion of a miracle that actually abets secularization, because he's basically saying that the miracle reveals to us this faith world. This faith world's over here, but that leaves the work world over here, in which faith and God just aren't present. So the interesting thing here is that we have a miracle that actually increases the kind of secularity of the secular world. A second consequence is that we have a notion of miracle that appears to disenchant the world. On the one hand, the miracle of revelation, which this revelation that discloses to an individual a faith world parallel to this one, perhaps we can call this a re-enchantment, so people get faith ideas. But if this is a re-enchantment, it's of a peculiar kind. First of all, it is for an individual and not of the world itself. So you could say that the gods that might once have inhabited rocks, those gods have not returned. And second, this enchantment transpires in a faith world, not the lawfully ordered nature, which that faith world was meant to negate. Third and last, I think it's easy to see how the terms Bultmann used to describe the miracle and its counterconcepts are part and parcel of a critique of modern liberal civilization. So for one, his rhetorical stress on the gift is an alternative to the contractualism that pervades liberal languages of economics and politics. Second, his stress on the negation of a specifically processual or procedural lawful order dovetails quite nicely with similar moves that we can find in critiques of liberal jurisprudence. Third, Bultmann's hostility to a world that understands itself in terms of what it makes is of a piece with critiques of liberal, not to mention socialist traditions of thinking about labor and of the objectification of labor in the world in the form of works. So in the end, we're left with a series of oppositions. We have grace versus works, we have faith versus law, and we have gift versus sale. Seen in this light, embedded in Bultmann's view of the miracle is a fully fledged Pauline critique of liberal modernity, and perhaps along with it, a kind of metaphysical anti-Judaism. And here's how, as Bultmann writes of the Jews, the essential nature of their godlessness stands out clearly in this attitude that they understand themselves in terms of what they accomplish or in terms of their works. So he's saying that Jews don't get this revelation of the faith world that takes us out of the work world. Stated a little bit more, we find in Bultmann a critique of modernity that is uncannily coded by the distinctions that were once used by Paul to argue for the superiority of the new dispensation to the old one. What I'd like to do now is try to show to you how a lot of the ideas that Bultmann develops get taken up by a philosopher named Hannah Arendt, a German-Jewish emigre intellectual, and we want to see how she invokes the terms of the miracle in Bultmann, how she uses them to basically criticize the world that she lives in, namely the world of 1958, when she wrote a very now famous book called The Human Condition. Now, The Human Condition, this book that Arendt wrote, is one of the most astonishing books that I know. It's also astonishingly complex. And it's so astonishingly complex that I wrote myself into knots trying to produce a text that would be intelligible to those of you who know the book and of interest to those of you who don't. So I'm going to start with just a few basic points about what the book is trying to do to get us into the meat of the discussion. So the title of the book, The Human Condition, the word condition refers to the conditions that make human life possible. And on Arendt's view, there are three of these. She calls them earthliness, worldliness, and other people. So first of all, we live on an earth, but more specifically, we are biological beings. And in this respect, we are what Arendt calls animal laborans. That's the kind of the term she invents to describe this aspect of our being. And it refers to things like reproduction, or maybe things like agriculture, eating, the stuff that we have to do in order just to live as biological beings, these automatic natural processes. Then we have something that she calls a world, and this is very much akin to what Bultmann says is our work world. The world for Arendt refers to the world of objects that we make, the world of buildings that we build, and this corresponds to our artifactual being, our being as creatures that make stuff. And her name for this kind of being is Homo Faber. And then we have a third condition for human being, namely other people, or a plurality of persons. And she says that this is the enabling condition for being a political animal or engaging in politics. And when Arendt talks about politics or doing politics, she wants to call it action. She talks a lot about political action. And when she talks about political action, she's basically defining it as the capacity to inaugurate something new, to bring something new into the world. And this is kind of an idiosyncratic understanding, but it's an important one. So on the one hand, these conditions that Arendt lays out for us, these conditions enable human life. You can't have human life without them. On the other hand, these conditions constrain human life. If you were, say, to try and leave the Earth behind in a rocket ship, it's unclear whether you would any longer live a properly human life, at least on Arendt's view, because you would lack earthliness. Or if you were, say, to try to do away with skillful work by replacing humans with automatons or with robots, it's unclear whether you'd be left with persons who could properly be called human. In this instance, the threat is that the activity that is proper to one realm of being would have colonized another. So you could say that, in theory, Arendt is worried about two kinds of problems. The first problem is trying to emancipate ourselves from the conditions that make specifically human lives possible. And the second problem, the second kind of problem, is trying to import the activities that are proper to one realm of being or one realm of human capacity into another. Okay, so those are the theoretical kinds of problems that she's interested in. And right now they probably sound a bit abstract. Well, what about the world that she actually inhabits? What does the future of the human condition look like in 1958? Well, people, it looks pretty bleak. Arendt commences her book with a discussion of Sputnik, the satellite, which she describes as an earthborn object made by man and launched into the universe. And she calls this the event second in importance to no other, in part because it exemplifies a twofold threat to the human condition. On the one hand, it represents the beginnings of our attempts to leave the Earth behind. And on the other hand, as a man-made heavenly body, it symbolizes our efforts to replace the living Earth with an artificial planet, or to replace the grown with the made, or in Arendt's terms, to end the contingencies of earthliness, for example, that we are born as heteronomous creatures with the mastery of the world that we build. Now, when Arendt turns to human society, things look even worse. Modern societies are mass societies, she notes, and this wreaks havoc with the human condition. So you can think first about the world of our works, what we make, or our art, broadly construed. Okay, now we can invoke Walter Benjamin for a moment. So in a very famous essay called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, an intellectual named Walter Benjamin, opted for a resolutely anti-nostalgic take on what it actually means to make art or to make things in the age of its technical reproducibility. And he also opted for a resolutely progressive embrace of such technologies because he thought that it decoupled the work of art from its traditional cultic contexts. I don't want to digress too much, but just to give you a little bit of background so you understand what I'm talking about, he's talking first and foremost about what we traditionally call art. And he says that part of the power of an artwork, say a painting, is that it... Part of the power of an artwork, say a painting, is the aura that is attached to it. And this aura is basically just the residue of the meanings that this artwork has acquired in its cultic context, namely the context of the rituals that have surrounded it. And Benjamin is writing in the age of mechanical reproducibility. And so a photograph would be a perfect example of this. We can reproduce these things infinitely. And he's asking, what happens to that aura of tradition, that aura of ritual, in an age when things can be reproduced without end? And he says that the aura gets lost. And he's happy about this, because he says that it opens up new progressive opportunities. The implication, though, is that or arguably the implication is that the stability of the object world, the stability of the world comprised of the things that we make, that this stability gets undone. And this is something that Arendt is very much concerned with. So by comparison with Benjamin, Arendt is a cultural conservative. She's worried that the gargantuan networks of production and consumption that we have created, that all of these things have destabilized the object world, the world that humans have built, and that all of this spells trouble. So my favorite example in The Human Condition is when Arendt talks about this table. It's an old table. It's probably been used for several generations by the same by a family. It's this table that has mediated discussions. The table brings people around it, so we're brought together through and by this table. It also separates us at the same time. It kind of enables human sociability. It has all kinds of marks and dings in it. You can tell that it's been used over time, and that this kind of use over time lends it a sense of stability. And Arendt thinks that it's really important that our object world have this kind of sense of stability to it. You might compare that with IKEA tables that are built not to last, but really to be consumed almost instantaneously. So Arendt would basically look at some of the developments that Benjamin celebrates and note how they make a properly human life impossible, in part by consigning us to a kind of IKEA-ized hellhole in which the objects that endow our world with a semblance of stability actually endow it with meaningless transience instead. Okay, so maybe I got a bit carried away with IKEA there. But the point is this: technological reproducibility changes the character of what we make and how we make it, and in Arendt's view, largely for the worse. Now, it also changes the kind of persons that we are and the kind of politics that we pursue. Individuals who think and individuals who act, they're out. Masses is where it's all about. So masses are in, and the sort of exchangeable person units that comprise masses, they don't think, they don't act, instead they behave. And this is why they're studied by the so-called behavioral sciences. The political ideal, though whether it is actually a politics or an ideal is open to question, the political ideal that's proper to such groups of masses is bureaucracy, which Arendt calls rule by nobody. And by that, she means that masses can be bureaucratically administered because they behave in statistically measurable patterns, they behave in statistically regular patterns, they behave in statistically rule-governed patterns. So you might say that Arendt is extending Bultmann's critique of our routinized workaday world and updating it, even radicalizing it, for an era in which technological reproducibility has become the governing precept of her time and perhaps our own. It gets worse. The obsessive focus on herd-like behavior might understandably generate a need to discover those who can still manage to do something unpredictable, those people who can act in ways that cannot be anticipated. And in the past, Arendt thinks, we might have looked to the political realm to find such men. But nowadays, or rather in her days, we have to look to scientists, which is ironic because it's the rise of modern science that is in part to blame for our plight. And the ironies compound because it is the atomic scientists who best exemplify the capacity to act or to introduce the new into the world. And that is because they have unleashed cosmic forces, let's say the kind of forces that you might find on the surface of the sun, the kind that you might think belong just fine on the surface of the sun, but the kind that you wouldn't be too happy to encounter down the block. These atomic scientists have unleashed cosmic forces in the household of terrestrial nature on Earth in the form of basically atomic explosions. So to sum up, we find ourselves with a society that can be rescued only by the unexpected disruption of its routinized regularity, but we also find ourselves with a world in which the atom bomb best embodies that hope. Okay, so right now, perhaps you might be thinking, Arendt sounds like just another mid-century German emigre intellectual sourpuss with an inexplicable animus toward earth-destroying weapons and the modern world that made them. Or perhaps you're considering her critique of modern mass society and thinking, listen up, Arendt, don't deprive me of my IKEA products. I love my IKEA, I don't know if this is what it's called, Hergely-Berg plant holder. It's awesome, and it nicely complements my IKEA burgundy black lavender scent candles. So just don't go there, Arendt. Or maybe you're thinking that all of this sounds nice, or rather that it all sounds utterly terrifying, which is to say convincing as an analysis of Arendt's world, even convincing as an analysis of our own. But you're wondering, what does any of this have to do with miracles? And you would be absolutely right to wonder. Because it's perfectly possible to make the sort of arguments that Arendt makes without recourse to the miracle, or even without recourse to religious arguments at all. And yet, making recourse to the miracle in religion is precisely what she does. Not only do miracles make an appearance in the human condition, I would go so far as to say that the book is saturated with them. So we can take as one example the atom bomb. Arendt likens the bomb to a miracle. For all of its destruction, it's experienced as the miraculous revelation of cosmic forces in a terrestrial realm, and it is enabled by a modern science that effectively works with a God's eye view of the Earth in its entirety. So atomic scientists, Arendt is arguing, act into nature, act into earthly nature from outside it, just like God, and this makes them the most obvious miracle workers of her age. But it's not just the bomb that gets likened to a miracle. I'd argue that Arendt's entire architectonics of human being, this kind of tripartite structure of the human condition, as it were, actually hinges on her use of the miracle, at least as a metaphor. She tells us, for example, that the animal laborans, the kind of biological man, can be, quote, redeemed from its predicament of imprisonment in the ever-recurring cycle of the life process, only through the mobilization of another human capacity, the capacity for making, fabricating, and producing. She tells us further that Homo faber, the creature that does make, fabricate, and produce, that Homo faber can be redeemed from his predicament only through the interrelated faculties of action and speech, faculties that are proper to the realm of politics. And here she is in sum. What in each of these instances saves man, man qua animal laborans, qua homo faber, qua thinker, is something altogether different. It comes from the outside, not to be sure outside of man, but outside of each of the respective activities. From the viewpoint of the animal laborans, it is like a miracle that it is also a being which knows of and inhabits a world. From the viewpoint of homo faber, it is like a miracle, like the revelation of divinity, that meaning should have a place in this world. Now, last, of course, we have the best-known example of the miracle in the human condition, and this is the miracle of political action. Sometimes Arendt likes to call this the miracle of natality, which is basically a fancy word for birthiness or beginnings. And in the human condition, Arendt introduces this idea of natality not to describe a literal biological condition, but instead to describe a principle that is at the heart of political action. She thinks that it refers to a kind of open-ended futurity, that it refers to the unintended consequences of an act in the political arena that brings something new into being. To be sure, all of this may only prove Arendt's point, or at least one of them, namely that the very difficulty of transcending religion made its appeal nearly irresistible precisely at the moment of possible farewell. Now, this was the conundrum that was confronted by political revolutions, Arendt argued in another text, which suffered the felt need for an absolute to ground its new order. But we could also say that it's the conundrum confronting Arendt herself. Arguably, her texts perform precisely the quandary that she is describing. Still, why would Arendt bother to make her appeal in such language at all, given her recognition of the danger? Why not simply use another language altogether, or at least one not so obviously beholden to its religious foundations? I guarantee you it is not because she lacked the creative ability to do so. She did not merely risk, at least not unwittingly, the destabilization of her own project. She did not simply perform it despite herself. Either she embraced that risk, did not think it an especially worrisome problem, or resigned herself to its necessity. And so basically we return to the question, was Arendt's recourse to theological language truly the consequence of the sway that religion holds even over those who renounce it? Or is it true, as the subtitle of Christopher Hitchens' book holds, that religion poisons everything? Or maybe was it a function of something else, of the fact that we are earthbound and worldbound creatures, that we are constitutively bounded, that we are constitutively conditioned, and will always require some sort of language to express that which exceeds us, whether that language is theological or something else. So theology, it turns out, might be just one among several tools that we have to describe this dimension of the human condition. Whatever the case, it seems hard to avoid the conclusion that Arendt looks alternatively to the languages of theology and philosophy to articulate a series of concerns that are embedded in both, but reducible to neither one. Thanks very much for your patience.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Benjamin Lazier from the Department of History at Reed College. Professor Lazier's lecture was titled Miracles in an Age of Technological Reproducibility and was presented by Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion and Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of Religion and Acting Director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies, Michael Zank. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.